All right, so yeah, we're holding on page 70 in Yoma, about the middle of the page, Uri and Os Ayin. You have a section over there that begins with parenthesis of Masechta Erevin. We learned yesterday about the concept of Tosfos Mechol al HaKodesh, that you have to add an extra time at the beginning and end of Yom Kippur, and not only Yom Kippur, but also Shabbos and Yom Tov and every other time that the Torah tells you to rest. And we talked about two different ways of learning that. Do we learn it from the fact that the Pasuk says, V'sish al HaKodesh Ba'erev, or do we learn it from the fact that the Torah says, Be'etzem Ayem Azeh, a person eats or does Malacha, gets Kodesh, implying that there's another time, which is not Etzem Ayem Azeh, when it's also to do those things, but he's not Chayav Kodesh. So now he brings in a piece over here. So now the Mechaber of En Yaakov brings in a piece over here from Masechta Erevin that also relates to the days of Yom Tov. So Rav and Shmuel, the Ami Tavayu, ain Omer's man El B'Sholosh Regalim. So Rav and Shmuel both say that you only say Shechionu only on the Sholosh Regalim, meaning, in other words, that they would say they're saying you don't say it on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur or Shmini Atzeres. So the Gemara says, Mesvi, I have a contradiction though. The Pasuk says in Tehelis, Ten Chelek L'Shiva V'Gam L'Shmona. Give a portion for the seven and also for the eight. So what do those seven and eight mean? The seven refers to the 7 days of creation. So among them, give one day to Hashem, namely the one day of Shabbos out of every seven. And the eight refers to the 8 days of Mila. You had a baby boy, give one day to Hashem and have the bris Mila on the eighth day. Rabbi Yeshua says when it says seven means the 7 days of Pesach, where you have to give a portion. So Rabbi Eliezer is understanding that it means you give a portion out of the seven. Out of the 7 days, you take one of them and you give it to Hashem as a portion, as Shabbos. And the same thing, one out of the 8 days after a baby is born. Rabbi Yeshua is saying it means that all the 7 days of Pesach, you're giving a portion to Hashem, which we're going to explain in a second what the Gemara assumes that means. L'shmoina elu chesi me'achad. When it says to eight, means the 8 days of Sukkot plus Shmini Atzeres. Obviously, we're talking in Eretz Yisrael. So Omer v'gam, the pasuk says ten. It doesn't just say ten chelik l'shiva u'l'shmoina. It says ten chelik l'shiva v'gam l'shmoina. So the word v'gam says Rabbi Yeshua l'rabbis atzeres for Rosh Hashanah v'yom Kippurim. That comes to include also that whatever it is that Shlomo is telling us to be careful of during the 7 days of Pesach and the 8 days of Sukkot also applies to Shavuos and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. My lav loymer's man. Shouldn't we assume that he means as far as saying the bracha shechionu? So therefore, that would mean that, yes, we do say Shech Yonu on all those days. And the answer is loy, not necessarily the bracha. It means as far as saying the bracha, that on all of them you say the Kaddish Yisro of Azmani. Or, okay, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You don't say that exact nusach, but you say a special Yom Tov bracha. You don't daven a regular weekday davening. So therefore, it could still be, the Gemara is saying that you could still say that, in fact, you only say Shech Yonu only on the Sholosh Regalim and not on Rosh Hashanah and not on Yom Kippur. In the end, halacha is not like that, and of course we do say zman, we do say shech yonu on all those days as well. When it comes to Yom Kippur, we don't have a kiddush, so we say it that day, so we say it right after Kol Nidre, and by the other ones we always say it by kiddush. The only Yom Tov that we don't say shech yonu, by the way, is Shvi Shal Pesach, and the reason is because it's not a separate Yom Tov, unlike Shmini Atzeres, which is a separate Yom Tov for many purposes. The seventh day of Pesach is not a separate Yom Tov, so there's no Shech Yonu, because you can't really say that Hashem brought us to this season. It's still just a continuation of the preceding Yom Tov. Marsha mentions, by the way, over there on that this Gemara again, this little piece that we just learned is a piece from Erevin. Marsha says over there, the reason why the Gemara assumed that we're talking about Shech Yonu, and now we're saying that it means as far as the Bracha, why is the Gemara assuming that Rabbi Yeshua is talking about something in davening? Because the Pasuk continues there in Tehelis, Kiloi Seda Matiya Ra'ala Oretz. You don't know what kind of evil is going to befall the world. So therefore, Rabbi Yeshua is explaining that that refers to the korbanos, where the korbanos are meant, among other things, to be mechaper for us, and therefore to protect us from punishment by Hashem. And, but you also don't know when there might come a bad time when there are no korbanos available, and therefore make sure to daven, which tefillos b'makom are in the place of korbanos, and therefore the Gemara is assuming that we're talking about something in davening. Either shechianu, or saying, according to Rav and Shmuel, it would have to mean saying the Baruch HaMekadosh Yisrael Vazmanim. But again, the Gemara's maskana is not like that, that in fact we do say shechianu on all of those yom tovim. Okay. The Mishnah starts talking, the next Mishnah here in Yoma talks about we know that the Kuach Nefesh is Deucha, almost Kola Tera Kola, including Yom Kippur. So the Mishnah mentions that if a pregnant woman smells food on Yom Kippur and has a craving for it, then if need be, you can give her some of the gravy or the soup from the food in order to still her hunger. And if that doesn't help, then you have to give her from the food itself. The Alter Rebbe has a different story. What? I mean, Alter Rebbe is not Jew. That's right. So you have the story with the Alter Rebbe is right that there was this woman who had just given birth and she didn't have any food in her house. So the Alter Rebbe went there on Yom Kippur and chopped wood and cooked food for her. Right. Here we're talking the other way around. She has food, but she also has a craving, and therefore it's dangerous for her and for the baby. So therefore,
the idea is that because she was very dangerous.
That's why the Alter Rebbe was Machal Yom Kippur for her, right? It's a vaguely similar concept, but it's not exactly the same. By the way, if you want,
it has to be sheared though, right?
What?
Sheared has to be small amounts.
So when a person needs to be fed on Yom Kippur, you usually try to do, the Gemara talks about Hakal Tchila, you try to do the minimum Isser first. With certain exceptions. So yeah, in this case, for example, the Gemara is going to point out, the Inyakov, he is going to quote a piece from the Gemara that says just that in the case of a pregnant woman. Yeah. With another kind of sick person as well, you give them a possible pachas mikashir, and then yeah. There's a story in Sipur Chassidim, by the way, where they have, there was some tzaddik, I don't remember who, where in his shul one time there was a rich yid who was known to be a terrible miser. And one time on Yom Kippur, he fainted from thirst. So everybody, whole hullabaloo, and everybody's gonna start. Some people are saying at first, he deserves it. I mean, the fact of the matter is, look at all this time, he never wanted to give a drink to a poor person, let him suffer that as well. But okay, the fact is, it's a matter of pikuach nefesh. So the Rav tells them, you have to give him pachas mekashir. But it's not helping. Until finally, the tzaddik tells them, tell him that for every cup of water he drinks now, he has to give a certain large amount of money to tzedakah after Yom Kippur. And they did, and the guy's thirst vanished instantly. So Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa. If a pregnant woman, now here, which are, the original thing was talking about as far as Yom Kippur, but more generally throughout the year, you could have the same kind of thing as well. She smells meat of kodshim, and let's say she's not able to eat it, whether because it's kodshim that are reserved only for koyanim and she's not a bas koyan or the wife of a koyan, whether because she's tomei, whatever it is, she smells meat of kodesh, oy basar chazir, or the polar opposite, she smells chazir flesh. And she has a craving, and again, it could endanger her and her baby. The first thing we do, we take a spindle, which is a kind of very large, oversized needle, and we stick it into the soup, and we put some of it on her mouth. There is a concept called, in halacha, called tam ke'ikr, that the taste of something has the status of, like, the ikr of the actual issur itself. It's a discussion among the Rishonim, whether it's daraisa or darabanan. Whatever the case, the point is, even if we say it's darabanan, then for sure, having the soup itself is not the ikr of the issur, so therefore it's not as bad. Even if it is daraisa, it's still not as bad as eating the actual issur. So you start with that. If that calms her down, mutter, then good. If not, then you give her from the actual soup, not just a taste of it on the end of a spindle, but rather an actual spoonful or cupful or whatever of it. If that calms her down, good. And if not, then they give her from the actual fat of the kodshim or the chazir flesh. Because nothing stands in the way of pikuach nefesh except for those, the big three aveiros. Strictly speaking, actually, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin, you do have a different exception also, Shas HaShmad, but we're not talking about that over here. We're not talking about, there's no, nobody trying to force them, nobody trying to force them to violate Yiddishkeit. We're just talking that she has a quake. So if somebody is forcing a person to do Avodah Zarah, but also, for example, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, it also includes, there's a concept with all these three, there's a concept called Abizrayu, which means like the outgrowths or the auxiliaries of it. Meaning, for example, to take something of Avodah Zarah and use it for a cure would also be osur. Let's say the Gemara talks about Nisachim, for example, to take wood from an Asherah tree and use it for a medicine, you wouldn't be allowed to do, because the Asherah is osur as a thing that's used to worship for Avodah Zarah, so therefore it's osur for Pekuach Nefesh for that purpose as well. But yeah, even the, what it is, yeah, I mean, there can also be where a person is forcing somebody to do it, but the Gemara there in Sanhedrin draws distinctions. First of all, there's a difference whether it's Pahesia or not. You have different opinions about it in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, but it depends whether it's Pahesia, meaning that 10 Jews know about what's going on. You have the difference of whether it's a Shas HaShmad, whether Goyim are deliberately trying to stamp out Yiddishkeit, like, for example, the communists in Russia, or the Nazis, or Antiochus, or Adrianus, and so on and so forth, different times in Jewish history. Anyway, but you have these are the big three, which Pekuach Nefesh has to give way for that. So the Gemara says, Avodah Zarah Menolon. Where do we know that Avodah Zarah is an exception to that rule, and you don't do Avodah Zarah even for Pekuach Nefesh? The Tanya, Rabbi Yezer Oymer. Im nema b'chol nafshecha, lama nema b'chol ma'oydecha, v'im nema b'chol ma'oydecha, lama nema b'chol nafshecha. Why in Krishna does it have to say, v'ahakdes Hashem alakecha, b'chol levavcha, o b'chol nafshecha, o b'chol ma'oydecha? Why b'chol nafshecha, o b'chol ma'oydecha? Because im yeshlecha adam shegufoy chaviv olamim mamonai, you may have the kind of person whose body is more important to him than his wealth. So v'chak nema b'chol nafshecha, to him the Torah is addressing with the words b'chol nafshecha. You have to be aware, you have to be ready to give up your body and your life for Torah, for Hashem. And that's in the after Hashem alakecha, means you have to love Hashem, and what's one way of expressing your love for Hashem? You're not going to go and worship a power other than Hashem. So therefore we see that Avodah Zarah is implied in that passage. You might, on the other hand, have somebody whose money is worth more to him than his guf. Now, you could argue such a person is not normal. Nevertheless, the Torah has to address such a person as well. So, therefore, the Torah also says, even if it means that you have to lose your entire fortune, nevertheless, you do that for to avoid worshipping Avodah Zarah. So we see that Avodah Zarah is an exception to the rule. Next, how do we see that the same rule applies to Gilead Ayas and Shishvichas Damim? We can learn those both from the same thing. So that's as follows. The Tanya, Rebbe Omer, Rebbe says, yeah, you have a Pasuk. The Pasuk describes a case where a Naira Moirasa, a Naira is a girl within 6 months after Bas Mitzvah, or strictly speaking, 6 months after she developed Shteis Virus. She's called a Naira. This one is Moirasa. She's already Moireses. She's Mekudeshes to a man. They had done only the Erosin, not the Kedushin. And now, the Pesukim describe, in Parshas Kisetze, you can have a case where a man goes and rapes her, and you have the dinim over there. It talks about that if it's in particular, it talks about if it's in the field, meaning someplace far away from people, then we assume that it was ba'onus. We assume she tried to scream out for somebody to save her, and nobody was around to save her. And therefore she's potter. We don't punish her, and the guy who did it is chayav misa.
So she's engaged, but not married.
She's engaged, well, not really engaged. That's the thing. Engaged is not really, engaged doesn't really have a status in halacha. It's mekudeshes. You know that a Jewish marriage has two stages, kiddushin and nisurin. Nowadays, we do them back to back. The kiddushin is the giving of the ring. The nisurin is the chuppah and everything that goes together with that, including yichud. There's actually different opinions among the Rishonim what exactly constitutes chuppah, whether it's what we think of as chuppah, standing there under the chuppah, or whether it's the yichud room, or whether it's the kala wearing a veil, or whatever. The point is that the point is a Jewish marriage has two stages. After kiddushin, you have already, she's an eshes ish, if she's mezana, then she and the other person are chayav misa, depending which ones were doing it beratzon, etc. Except that she and her husband are not allowed to live together yet. After Nisuin, then they are. in later times, beginning from the time of the Rishonim, they started doing Kiddushin and Nisuin together, which is how we do it nowadays. Engagement is something else. An engagement, strictly speaking, doesn't have these dinim. You would, for example, a couple wants to break an engagement, there's no get needed, as opposed to if they wanted to break a Kiddushin, they need a get. But in practice, it's not the poskim are very against the idea of breaking an engagement, but the fact is that it wouldn't require a get if they did that. So yeah. They often translate kiddushin in English as betrothal, but that has the same problem, really. Betrothal is just a fancy way of saying engagement, and it has the same problem, it doesn't really mean that.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is here we're talking about a girl in this stage. Usually they would have, back then they had a year between the kiddushin and the nisuin. During that time, she would be preparing the things for her, for the wedding, her gown and her jewelry and her cosmetics and whatnot. And the chosin, meanwhile, would be making his preparations. Anyway, so we're talking about during that time. So she's a naira, she's maridosa, and then somebody finds her in the field and rapes her. So the pasuk says, ki kasha yoko. So the pasuk says that you don't punish her because since it was out in the field, we assume it was shaloi v'rotzen. We assume that it was an onus. And the pasuk says, ki kasha yoko isha re'ehu v'tzochei nefesh. Just as it is when a person stands up against somebody else and kills him, kein hadavar hazeh, that's how this thing is. Now, you have to ask, what are we supposed to be learning from a ritzeach to a naira ha'marotzen? What chiddush is there in the case? What is the Torah telling us? Wouldn't we have realized on our own? Once the Torah says at the beginning of the pasuk, "V'lanara le'sasa dover," don't do anything, don't punish the girl in any way because she's not responsible. Why does the Torah need to add this comparison to a ritzeh? So Ella, I raise a bola lamed v'nim to lamed. This is one of those cases where it makes it sound as though the pasuk is coming to teach you something, and actually you learn something in the other direction. You actually learn something in both directions. Meaning, in other words, the Torah is comparing. The Torah, by saying this, is making a hekesh between murder and this case of rape. And we learn from that, therefore, in both directions. Ma naira marosa nitin latzila b'nafshoi. Just like with the naira marosa, you would be allowed to save if an onlooker, if somebody passes by and sees what's going on, he's allowed to save her from this guy who's about to rape her, even if it's necessary to kill her. And we learn that. Now she explains, based on other Gemaras, because the pasuk says that she screamed out, "Ve'ein Moshiach Allah," and there was nobody to save her, implying that if there was somebody available to save her, he would be responsible to do that, even if it requires killing the guy who's about to rape her. After Ritzeach Chula, we learn the same thing. It's true as far as a Ritzeach, that if you see one person chasing after another with intent to kill, then also you're allowed to kill the Roid. Strictly speaking, elsewhere, the Gemara talks about you have to try to first incapacitate them if possible. If you're a good enough shot, for example, and you're able to injure them in a way that will prevent them from doing the murder or the rape, then you have to do that. And if you can't, you're too far away, or you're not a very good aim or whatever, then you can do it even if it involves killing them. So we learn that from that comparison, and we also learn in the other way around. The Marit Seach Yehorek Val Yaver, just like killing is a Yehorek Val Yaver thing, meaning, as the Gemara is going to give an example in a minute, yeah, if a goy tells a yid, you kill somebody or I'm going to kill you, af Naira Marosa, Yehorek Val Yaver, so we learn also by the Naira Marosa is also a Yehorek Val Yaver. If the person is going to be, if a man is going to be forced to, they're going to tell him, you have relations with this Naira Marosa, or for that matter, any other era, any other case where it's a Bia Asura, then he has to be Mosa Nefesh rather than do it. You have, by the way, on this Gemara over here, you have an enormously long Tosfos. It starts on Amud Aleph, and then you turn to Amud Beis, and you have this gigantic Tosfos filling up most of the Amud. I once heard somebody call such a thing an iceberg Tosfos. Like, you look on one side, and you don't realize how big it is, and then you turn the Amud, whoa. Anyway, Tosfos has a long, long discussion about the ins and outs of this. In particular, Tosfos focuses on the question, is the Yehorek Val Yaver only for the man or also for the woman? Now, there's a sugya in Sanhedrin where it discusses this whole matter of Yehorek Val Yaver that bears on this. The Gemara says over there, Esther Tauka Olam Havori, that Esther was a situation of a Bia Asura, because after all, Achashverosh is a goy, plus the fact that she was married to Mordechai, and yet we don't find that she was Moisa Nefesh to avoid being taken to Achashverosh's palace. So does that mean that women are not obligated in this kind of thing at all? Or does it mean it depends on the circumstances? Yeah, there ends up being, there's this long tosfos on the subject. There's a good deal of discussion among the Rishonim and ultimately in Shulchan Aruch on the details of that.
The story that happened.
Yeah, with Peshel Lepine, you're talking about? Yeah, that would be an example of that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so now there is Tosfos mentions in this connection, yeah, Gemara at the beginning of Ksubas, where the Gemara mentioned that even if women, there was a time, we know before the story of Hanukkah in particular, the Goyim and Medic Zera, that any woman before she gets married to boil the hegman tchila, she has to submit to having relations first with the local goyish warlord. And the Gemara mentions over there that many women were most nefesh not to do that, even though the Gemara said technically they're not required to, because again they're passive in it. The man is the active one because ain't tishri elo adas. The woman is the passive one. Nevertheless, yeah, there were many women who were most nefesh not to do that. So yeah, you're mentioning Peshalei Lepine Hayad is an example of that in our times as well. Yeah. But anyway, like I said, Tosfos has a big, long discussion about that, and even Tosfos says there may even be a case where even the man, normally we say the man is the active one, and there's no way for it to be considered an onus. Because in Kishir Lodas, nevertheless, Tosfos discusses there can be circumstances where it is, and as far as with Sicha as well. Anyway, it's a big, long subject. Anyway, so the Gemara continues. Okay, so what are we saying? We're learning because we have a hekesh in the pasuk between Retzeach and Naira Marosa, therefore we're learning just like Retzeach is Yehoreg Val Yaver, so is Naira Marosa. But where do we know Retzeach itself from? How do we know that that's an exception to the rule that Pikuach Nefesh Doicha Kol HaTorah? So the answer is Svarim. That kind of thing is a Svarim. As we have the example, Dahuda Osula Kameda Rava, there was a Yid who once came to Rava with a Shaila. Omale, he says, Omale Mori Duroi, the master of my village, I mean the mayor or the poritz or whatever it is who runs my village, tells me, Katli Laplanya, you go kill Ploini, who's a Yid, the Eloi Katilnalach, and if not, then this mayor threatens, I'm going to kill you. So this Yid comes to Rava with a Shaila, what should I do? Omale, so Rava tells him, Niktalach, better let this goy kill you, Velotikdo, rather than you should go kill the other Yid. My choses, because what makes you think otherwise? You're thinking, Gidoma didoch sumak tfei. You're thinking it's a matter of v'chai b'hem v'lo shiyomus b'hem, as the Gemara discusses in a later sugya in this Masechta, in this Perek, in fact. That you're thinking that, again, this is one of those things, just like most mitzvahs, our doicha pikuach nefesh, so is this. So you think your blood is redder, meaning more important to Hashem. Maybe the other guy's blood is redder. Meaning, in other words, Rashi teaches out, you're thinking a Yid's life is very precious to Hashem. Therefore, Hashem doesn't want it to be wasted needlessly, and therefore Hashem put it into the Torah, the rule of a Chai Bahem. But after all, Rava is telling him, look, in this case, the fact is, one Yid is going to be killed one way or the other. Either you're going to kill him, or this guy is going to kill you. So one way or the other, a Jewish life is going to be lost anyway. Better then that you should not do the Avera, rather than you save your life at the expense of another Yid's, where anyway a Jewish life is going to be lost. So therefore, that's a svara that Ritzicha is not Doicha Bikurach Nefesh, and once we have that svara, then we can apply it to the Naira HaMarasa or other kinds of Arayas and say the same rule. So that's where we get Avodah Zarah, Gila Arayas, and Shvichas Damim. Back to the case of the pregnant woman. The Gemara says, "Ihu ubra de arfa." It happened once that a pregnant woman smelled food on Yom Kippur. Also, lekamei de Rebbe. So they came to Rebbe to ask what to do. So he tells them, "Zilu luchushalo de Yom Kippurihu." Whisper in her ear that it's Yom Kippur. That may help. Because the Gemara understands that when a pregnant woman has this kind of craving, it's not her herself, it's actually coming from the baby. So if you whisper in her ear that it's Yom Kippur, the baby may pick up on that, and therefore that'll calm things down. So sure enough, they whispered to her that it's Yom Kippur, and sure enough it worked, and her cravings, or rather the baby's cravings stopped. Kori Ale, so Rebbe applied to him the pasuk, as Hashem says about you, "Yebeterem etzorcha babet nidaticha v'gomer." Before I even formed you in the womb, I knew you. Meaning, in other words, that Hashem, there are certain people that even before they're born, Hashem has already destined them for greatness. here, where this baby was in the womb, was already such a tzaddik, such a tzaddikal, that even you tell him it's Yom Kippur, and he'll stop his cravings, it shows that he has the potential to be a very great person. Sure enough, Nofak Minor Rabbi Yochanan, this woman gave birth to her baby, grew up to be the great Rabbi Yochanan. On the other hand, Hahi Ubra Z'Orcha, there was another pregnant woman who also smelled food on Yom Kippur. Also the Chamed Rav Chanina, so they came to Rav Chanina to ask what to do. Same thing, Amalahu L'Chushula, they told her whisper in her ear at Yom Kippur. This time, V'lo Yochisha, it didn't work, she still had the craving, and they ended up having to give her food. Kori Aleh, so Rav Chanina applied to that the pasuk, Zoru Rishoyim Merochem, the Rishoyim are strangers already from the womb. Meaning already this child already in the womb has a tendency, not obviously, I mean, by both of them, both by Rabbi Yochanan and this one, doesn't mean they're destined necessarily to be that way. But tzaddik v'rosh alei ka'amar, like it says, like the Alter Rebbe says on the first page of Tanya. But it means that the Rebbe saw, now Rabbi Chanina saw that these children have a tendency to become great or on the other hand to be a rosh. And sure enough, the Vilna Gaon points out why did he use that pasuk specifically? Because the next psukim after that, and this is in Kapitel Nun Ches and Tilim, continue Asher lo yishmal kur malachim. That this Rosha, who's compared to a snake there in the pasuk, won't listen to whisperers like this. You have snake whisperers, charmers that are able to charm a snake and prevent it from harming. Here the pasuk is comparing the Rishoyim to snakes that won't even listen to the charmer. So here we're saying they whispered. They whispered Asher lo yishmal kur. They whispered. And Lasher La Yishma, La Kermalachim, this baby wasn't listening to the whisperers and it didn't help.
How come in Tanya says, who Russia,
that's the thing, Tzaddik Rosh Hashanah, that's what I was just saying. Tzaddik Rosh Hashanah Karma means Hashem doesn't definitively say this person is going to be a Tzaddik or a Rosh. But we can still say a certain person, while they're in the womb, we can see in them they have a tendency, they have an inclination to become a great person, or they have a tendency and an inclination to be the other way around. Sure enough, Nofak Minosh, Shabsai, Otsapeiri, the result was her baby grew up to be the infamous Shabsai, the hoarder of pears. Now, the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that you're not allowed to hoard too much produce in it, more than a certain amount of produce in Eretz Yisrael, because that drives up the prices. What happens is a person goes and hoards and buys up as much as possible of the food and then stores it, and then the result is that prices go up, especially if there's a famine or something. This Shabsai used to specialize in this kind of thing. He would buy up all the available produce in order to hoard it and to be able to sell it at inflated prices when there were shortages, and that's an example of a Rosha who makes his fortune off the backs of the poor people, and therefore that's what we're saying, that it all started with that even in the womb he already had this tendency.
Yeah. On New Year's Eve, the price of tomatoes doubled.
Okay. Now, a few interesting things about this. Rashi specifically mentions the point that it was Yom Kippur in the first story. Now, the Chida asks the question, why does Rashi need to say that? The Gemara right here says that this was on Yom Kippur. And he explains, because Rashi wants to make an interesting point as follows. The Gemara mentions in a number of places that even behemtan shel tzaddikim, even animals belonging to tzaddikim, Hashem arranges that they don't eat dvarim ha'asurim, as we have the famous story with Rav Pinchas ben Yair's donkey that wouldn't eat grain that wasn't ma'aser. How much more so tzaddikim themselves. And Tosfos, in a few of those places, explains, specifically we're talking about that Hashem will prevent that a tzaddik will not eat a dvar isu, because like we have in Tanya, it was a last week in Tanya, you have that when a person eats food, it becomes damabos or kipsore, and it would be a shameful thing that a tzaddik's body should be made partially out of food that's osu. However, Tosfos mentions in some of those places, that's only when the food is intrinsically osu. So here, the Chida makes what says. Rashi wants to hint at the point. You have to ask, if Rabbi Yochanan has the destiny to be such a great tzaddik, how does he have a craving for food on Yom Kippur in the first place, to the point where they even need to whisper in his mother's ear? And the answer is, Rashi is saying, because the food's not intrinsically osur. It's just a day when food is osur. So therefore, that's not something that tzaddikim have a natural aversion to, and therefore there's no problem that Rabbi Yochanan had such a craving. Just that he was able to overcome it once they told him that it is in fact Yom Kippur.
Before you drink something, it's always a good idea to look into the coast.
Okay. Okay. Another very, I don't know what that has to do with, but okay. Okay. Another very interesting point in this connection that Rebbe mentions in a footnote to a letter about this point that Rabbi Yochanan was saying that when he was in his mother's womb, he was able to control his cravings once he knew that it was osur. Now Tosfos, now in Chagiga, you have the whole story of Acher, the whole tragedy of Acher, who was originally a great Talmud Chacham, and then we know what happened. Tosfos brings a long thing from the Yerushalmi there that mentions several things that predisposed them to that. One of them was there was a very similar story. When his mother was pregnant with him, she one time passed by a base of a desara. They were cooking a stew. She got a craving for it, and they ended up having no choice but to give her some of the stew in order to calm her cravings. And that again had a bad effect on her unborn baby, and therefore that was one of the things that made him more prone to becoming a rasha later in life. Now, the Gemara tells us there in Chagiga what happened after Acher passed away. They didn't know what to do with him at first in the base of Shamayla. They can't send him to Gehenim, who was a great Talmud Chacham. They can't send him to Gan Eden, look what he became. So for a while there, he's in limbo. Until Rav Meir, his faithful Talmud, says, I'll arrange for him to get into Gehenim so he can be cleaned up over there. And sure enough, smoke was coming from his caver. Later on, generations later, Rabbi Yochanan says, I think that Acher has had enough in Gehenim. I'm going to make sure when I go to the Beis Din Shamayla, I will get him schlepped out of there and brought to Gan Eden. And sure enough, he did. Now, so the Rebbe asks in a footnote, Rabbi Meir, we can understand, he was a Talmud of Acher. He was his faithful Talmud, as the Gemara tells over there. What did Rabbi Yochanan have to do with anything? And the Rebbe says, based on our Gemara over here, we see that Rabbi Yochanan and Acher went through the same kind of thing in the womb. Both of them, they had cravings, and their mother's life would have been in danger, but Rabbi Yochanan was able to control his, and Acher was not. No, we're not saying Acher is not in our Gemara over here, but Tosfos there in Chagiga brings from Yerushalmi that the same thing happened with Acher. Now, so what happened was, then, Rabbi Yochanan figured like this, says the Rebbe. We know, we learned earlier in the Masechta, for example, we have the example of Hillel Mechayev Aniyim and other examples like that, where a poor person comes in front of the Beis Din Shamayla and they ask him, why didn't you learn Torah? And he says, I couldn't afford to. And they said, look, Hillel was poorer than you, and he was able to. So in other words, they use Hillel as a makatrig kind of against the person. Now, Rabbi Yochanan figured they could use me in the Beis Din Shamayla for the same kind of thing against Acher. They could tell him, how is it that you couldn't control your craving and you forced your mother to eat treifas when I was able to? So therefore, Rabbi Yochanan figured exactly the opposite. Not only I don't want that to happen, that I should be used as a makatrig, adraba, I'll become his sanegar, I'll become his defender, and I'll be the one who defends him in front of the Beis Din Shamayla to make sure that he gets into Gan Eden. Beautiful thing that they're saying there. Onward. The whole letter, by the way, the whole letter, it's printed in Chelik Aleph of the Rebbe's Igros Kodesh. It's a fascinating letter. It started with, there was a chassid in Newark. He was one of the founders of the yeshiva over there, David Stockhammer. He had three daughters who all married prominent Lubavitchers, Ziskin, Moshe Pinchas Katz, and Mordechai Mendel, Alei Mashalim. Anyway, at one time, the Rebbe had published in those years a letter or a mimer or something from the Friedrich Rebbe that talked about the idea, Kol Yisrael Yashem Chayuk Alam Abba, and the Friedrich Rebbe says it means Kol Yisrael without exception. So this Rebbe David wrote to the Rebbe asking what he means, without exception. What about all the people that it says in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, Ve'elu Shein Lam Chayuk Alam Abba, etc. And the Rebbe writes back a letter going through blow by blow and showing how, no, what it really means, Kol Yisrael, without exception. Either they have a son or a Talmud who can help them. Sometimes you can have their father's chus helps him. You can have with Acher where somebody not even related like Rabbi Yochanan helps him. And you have, if necessary, it means they come back in another Gilgal, etc., etc. Yeah, in that whole letter you can see the Rebbe's not giving up on anybody. Okay. Onward. Like Gemara says, Tanan Abanan. Now the Mishnah goes on to describe another example of the Kuach Nefesh. On Yom Kippur, you can have a person who was struck with bulmus. So bulmus, it's related to the word bulimia in English. It means where a person has a terrible, dangerous craving for food, where if they don't, without it, their eyesight, their eyesight dims, their other senses are also not functioning correctly, and you need to give them food right there on the spot, otherwise they may die of it. What it would be in modern terms, I don't know. Maybe low blood sugar, maybe something else. I don't know. Whatever it is. It may well stem from a ruchniyistik problem, but here we're talking about it. The fact is, it's a gashniyistik ailment, and therefore you have to give him food as fast as possible. Yeah. By the way, there you don't even have the rule that you give him as little as possible at a time. Here, by a person who's eating who has bulmus, you need to give him a large amount to get him out of that. So therefore, then. Anyway, so the Mishnah had said that a person who has bulmus, then you give him to eat right away on Yom Kippur. until his eyesight is restored. So the Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, Misha Ochse Bomos, a person who was seized by Bomos, Machir Manoset Dvash Vachomine Mesika. They should give him honey or other kind, all kinds of sweet foods. Shad Dvash Vachomine Mesika, Me'irin Ma'ur Ein of Shaladam. Those kinds of things enlighten a person's eyes, they restore his eyesight. So that's what I'm saying. It could very well be that Bomos is like low blood sugar or whatever, and therefore you need to give him a huge dose of sugar right at the time. Anyway, whatever it is, the Afapishen Raya Ladover, even though there's no solid proof for that, Zecha Ladover, but there's a remembrance of that in a Pasuk. Because you have a Pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, the Psukim are telling over there a story. At one point, the Jews are fighting against the Plishtim. Shaul ordered that everybody should fast that day, so that they should have the schus of fasting and help them beat the Plishtim. Yonasan, Shaul's son, hadn't been there when Shaul made this vow. So as they're walking through the forest, he notices some honey or sugar oozing there on the ground, either honey from a beehive or sugar from sugar canes, and he dipped his staff, his walking stick in there, and tasted a little bit of it. And the people tell him, what about your father's shugur? So he says, no, look, you know what? Look at this, my eyes have lit up. Because I tasted a little bit of this honey. And he goes on to say, in other words, I think that what my father did was counterproductive. Like this, I understand he's trying to give the Jewish people a schus, but like this, on the other hand, everybody's hungry, and the result is they don't have enough energy to fight the Plishtim. If people were allowed to eat, then they'd have much more energy, and they'd be able to beat the Plishtim much more comprehensively. Anyway, so they have a hint in the Pasuk that Dvash has to do with Oru'en. So the Gemara says, "My afapishen ra'ei l'davar." So why is it not a solid proof? Because the Hasam la bulmos achse. Yonasan wasn't suffering from bulmos. So we want a proof that honey helps a person with bulmos and helps restore his eyesight. So you don't have a solid proof from that pasuk, but you have a hint to it in the fact that he associates honey with his eyes lighting. However, Amar Abaye lo shonu elo la'achar achila. That would apply only if you give him the sweet food after he eats some substantial food. But if you give it to him before he eats something else, migra gorer, then on the contrary, the sweet food will just provoke his appetite more. Dichtiv, as we have another example from another story in Sefer Shmuel, you have towards the end of Shmuel Aleph, David and his men are chasing after a band of Amalekim who had destroyed the city of Siklag and taken all of the women and children prisoner. And David and his men are chasing after them to fight them. Then the pasuk says, "Vayimtzu ish Mitzri basada." They found a Mitzri man lying there in the field. "Vayikroisel David." They brought him to David. "Vayitnu lechem vayoychal." They gave him bread to eat. "Vayashkuhu mayim." And then again, they gave him water to drink. And only then, "Vayitnu lechelach dvelo shnei." Then they gave him a slice of dried dates. Dvela is like you have igula dvela throughout Shas, which are large cakes out of pressed figs or pressed dates that are dried and pressed together. So they gave him a slice of that, ushnei tzimukim, and a couple of raisins, and he ate them, and his spirit returned to him, because up until then, he hadn't eaten or drank anything for 3 days and 3 nights. And he goes on to tell them, they ask him, where you're from? He tells them, I was a slave of an Amaleki, and I got sick, so my master just abandoned me there by the side of the road to die of hunger, and now I can show you which way the Amalekim went, and sure enough, he guides them to the camp, and they defeat the Amalekim. Yeah, today we have the Ishmael the other way around, it's true, yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean two raisins. It can mean two bunches of raisins, whatever. The point is that the pasuk is saying first they gave him bread and water, and only then they gave him the sweet stuff, the piece of dried date and the raisins. Because otherwise, if they had given that to him first, that would have whetted his appetite even more, and then he would have been in even more danger. Yeah. So the Gemara continues. Amar of Nachman Amar Shmuel, Misha Ochze Bomos, a person who was seized by Bomos, Machil and I say Al Yubedvash. What you should do is you should give him the fat tail of a sheep dipped or cooked with honey. The fat tail, the fattiest part of the meat of an animal. So between that, the fat plus the sweetness of the honey will help restore his strength. Rav Huna Breder Rav Ashur says you can also give him fine flour with honey, and that'll also help him. Rav Papa says you don't even need anything to get, you don't even need anything really good quality with the honey. even if all you have is barley flour, which is less, which is even less important than wheat flour, and you mix that with honey, that's good enough. That will help the person with bulbs. And the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yochanan, Pamachas Achazani Bulmus, one time I was struck by Bulmus, Viratzi the Mizracha Shotaina, so I ran to the east side of a fig tree, to eat some of the figs over there, Vikiyamti Ba'atmi Achochma Techaya Ba'aleha, with that I was Mekayim, I showed on myself, the Posit says, wisdom keeps its owner alive, meaning that I realized that the east side of the fig tree, first of all, the figs are sweet, but the east side is the side where the sun beats down the most strongly in the morning, and therefore the fruit on that side ripens the most and has the most sugar content.
Meaning so, that side of the tree.
Right. So in other words, the Tani of Yosef, as in fact Rav Yosef taught a Braisa. If a person wants to have the real full taste of what a fig is, Yifnel Mizracha, he should turn to the east side of the tree. Shenema, we megad tvoris shomish, as the pasuk says, in Moshe's bracha to Yosef, from the sweetness of the produce of the sun. So we see that when the produce is ripened by the sun, it becomes the sweetest. So therefore, on the east side of the fig tree is where you're going to find the sweetest figs. Yen Mashiach Gola, Chaf Aleph Tevis. Talking about this special adding in Limud HaTorah as far as Geula or Mashiach, it shouldn't just be a Segula, it shouldn't just be like one of these supernatural kind of things that will help bring Mashiach closer and the Geula closer. More importantly, this way we can start living with the Yoni Mashiach Geula to leaven mitzvah sight of Yemosa Mashiach, because that way a person's brain becomes full and becomes permeated with understanding all about Yoni Mashiach Geula Shabbat Torah, and then from the Seichel it goes and penetrates also the heart, there's the emotions in the heart, and eventually it reaches to actual practice machshava dibur ma'isa in the way that's appropriate for this special time when we're on the threshold of Gola, and we can already point with our finger and say hini zem alach mashiach ba. Continuing on halachas of kiddush of Shabbos, if wine becomes sour, then you can't make kiddush for it. You can't make kiddush on it. Also, if it has a bad smell, even if it's not actually sour, even if it still basically smells like wine and tastes like wine, and the fact is you would say very piagofen on it, but let's say for whatever reason, for example, it was in a dirty keli, then it smells bad, then you can't use it for kiddush. The Alter Rebbe actually says so somewhat differently, that if it tastes like wine, even if it smells like vinegar, you could use it for kiddush. Practically speaking, nobody's going to do that anyway. Also, if wine stayed uncovered for a few hours, now throughout Shas, you have a concept of gilui. You have a concept that if liquids are left uncovered for more than a few minutes, then you have a problem that a snake might have drunk from them and injected venom. In general, we're not careful about that, because Tosfos already points out where we live, snakes aren't that common. Nevertheless, we still have a concept called Hakrivehu Nalafecha Secha. The Navi Malachi says, you're bringing blemished animals or weak animals or whatever as korbanos. If you offered such a thing to your governor, would he accept it from you? No. So Allah is Kamalakami. You're offering something to Hashem, then it should be the best quality. And then he goes on to talk about wine that has mold in it or whatever. We're not going to talk much about that, because practically speaking, if you had that, you just throw it out anyway. We're talking about the night kiddush, but to a certain extent. Oh, not all night. He's just saying Eza Shois, he uses the expression, if it was left uncovered for several hours. So still, maybe you don't have the problem of snakes, but it still loses its flavor and whatever, and it's not really good quality to be using for kiddush anymore.